Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Michael Karnes of Exponential Audio. He's going to discuss everything you ever wanted to know about reverb. But first, let's talk about the CD, which you may think is fading fast, but believe me, it's still with us. The annual RIAA list of numbers came out, basically sales from the year 2014. They do this every year. They come out at the end of the first quarter, and they have a lot of sales numbers, what was selling, what wasn't. And one of the things we found out is that CD sales were again down. They were down by 16%, no surprise to anybody, but that still meant there was 144.1 million CDs sold last year. And that was $1.85 billion. And if you add up all the physical product, which includes vinyl and includes DVDs and includes CD singles and everything else that's physical, it was a little over $2 billion. That's a lot of money. And it's more than most people think that's being made in that part of the industry. One of the things that's interesting is that may be an undercounted figure. For instance, the way CDs are counted is by Nielsen SoundScan. It's been like this since 1991 or 92, I think. In order to do that, the barcode is essentially scanned at a retail music store or from Amazon, for instance. The barcode means everything. Once it's scanned, it registers as a sale. The only problem with that is that that doesn't count a whole lot of other CD sales. For instance, when a band or an artist sells CDs at a gig, it doesn't get registered. If you sell a CD from your website, that doesn't get registered. All of the church CDs that are made, and there are tons of them, none of that gets registered. And don't forget, there's still a lot of bootleg and pirated CDs that are still made all over the world, and none of that is counted. So we really don't know how big the CD market is. We know it's declining, but it may be twice as large as we think it is. This is kind of important because what it means is, even though the market for CDs is going away quickly, and I must admit, I don't buy CDs anymore. I don't want them. They take up a lot of room. You probably think the same thing. But the fact of the matter is, there are people that still want to have a CD. It makes sense to be able to make some. Now, it used to be that you had to have an order of 1,000 in order to make it worthwhile, and actually many pressing plants wouldn't even think about pressing less than that. But now you can find replicators that will do 500 and 250, no problem, and even down to 100. And there are companies like Kanaki.com, which will basically do anything from 2 to hundreds of thousands for the same amount of money, and they package them, and they look great, and they do it really fast, and they'll drop ship and everything, and it's really terrific. So you can still make CDs, and it won't cost you a lot of dough. You just have to remember that when it comes to a CD, packaging really counts. You can't just have a bland, blah CD cover. You really have to spend some money in the packaging. But at least for the time being, take CDs seriously because they're still happening and they'll still be around for a few years. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn a lot more. The next thing I want to talk about is the producer's vocal recording checklist. If you're producing a vocalist, there are a number of things that you can do to get the best out of that vocalist and the best vocal you possibly can. The first thing is, consider a handheld mic. The first thing that many people think about is, okay, what's the best mic in the studio? And let's use that. You have a U87, let's use that. There's a C12, let's use that. Is there a clone of one of those? Let's use that. Whatever is the best mic, let's break it out for the vocalist. Sometimes that's the worst thing. Sometimes you really want an SM57 or an SM58 handheld in the control room. You know who still does this? Bono of U2. Still, all these years later, that's the way he does all his vocals. Paul Rogers as well. Paul Rogers of Bad Company. So this is something that works, and you shouldn't discount it because it really works. So that's the first thing. Consider using a handheld mic. The next thing is the headphone mix at the correct level. The mix is really important, and a lot of times a vocalist really doesn't know how to get their own. So even though they may be able to manipulate 8 or 16 elements, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can do it. So it's really important that at least you get a basic mix for them to put together, and you get it at the right level. What does the right level mean? Well, if it's too loud, the vocalist may strain to get over the top of it and may go sharp and may sing too aggressively. If it's too quiet, they may also sing quiet and won't be aggressive enough and also might go flat. So that's why it's important to get just the right level. So this is a really important thing to think about and write off. It's one of the things that you should be concerned with. The next thing is the sound that's in the headphones, especially on the vocal mic. It's always nice to have just a touch of delay or a touch of reverb just to give that extra ambience. And you'll find that vocalists always seem to do a lot better if you have a little bit of it. The next thing is explain what's right and what's wrong. The worst thing you can do with the vocalist is just say, that wasn't good, do it again. What they really want is some guidance. They want to know what they did well and they want to know what they didn't do well. So you can really help a vocalist along by being very specific. The next thing, and maybe this is the most important, is the three P's. The three P's, this is put together by my friend Ed C., the great engineer producer in Nashville. Three P's are pitch, passion, and pocket. And you can't have a great vocalist without the three of them. Pitch, of course, being in tune. Now, you can always tune later, but the less you have to do, the better. The next thing is passion. Does the vocalist make you believe in the story that he or she is telling? Passion is really important. You can't have a great vocal without passion. And the third thing is pocket. So pitch, passion, and pocket. Pocket meaning being in the pocket of the song. And of course, you can change that later by slipping and sliding phrases and even words in your digital audio workstation. But the less you have to do it, the better off you are and the better the vocal is. So the three P's are really important. Pitch, passion, and pocket. And finally, is the microphone in the studio always on? And is the control room talkback always on? One of the things that vocalists and musicians in general that are doing overdubs, what they really hate is being isolated. So when they see people in the control room talking and they can't hear what the conversation is, they always think the worst. They always think that you're talking about them. Even if you're not, it's really important that you always keep that talkback mic on so they can hear what's going on in the control room. So if you want to get a great vocal, these are the things that you should always be thinking about. Because believe me, if one of these is off, it can lead to a vocal just not being as good as it can be. My guest today is Michael Carnes. He's one of the few humans on the planet that really knows how to make a great reverb plugin. And that's because he worked for 25 years at Lexicon and was responsible for a lot of the great reverbs that we all used back in the hardware days. Michael now heads Exponential Audio, and they make some excellent, reasonably priced reverb and effects plugins, and I highly recommend them. I spoke with Michael via Skype from a studio in Salt Lake City, Utah. Michael, thanks so much for being with me. This is great. I've wanted to talk to you for a long time. I'm glad we finally had a chance to do it.
I am so excited, Bobby. It's good to catch up with you after all this time.
No kidding. I know that you have an advanced degree in classical composition. How does one go from that to programming reverbs?
Well, there's a lot of incentive if you want to sleep indoors. I had always been a technical nerd, so there was really no real difference in mindset between being a composer and being an engineer or a scientist. They all stimulated the same parts of my brain. And I was quite fortunate when I was in graduate school, I was invited into the computer music program at MIT. Yeah, I was in school at Boston University. And Barry Virko, who ran the program at the time, was very much into bringing in someone from every conservatory in town because he just sort of wanted them to see what computer music was about. And I was the designated person from my school, and I went over, and it just clicked. It was computers were natural. I got it right away. And it wasn't long before they gave me a key to the place, and I ended up being a tutor in the program for a couple of years. So when I got out of school and then was facing that decision time, do I want to be one of 300 applicants for a part-time teaching job, or do I want to actually be able to stay in the same place? And it wasn't really hard. So I looked around, and in Massachusetts in those days, if you had a pulse, they would give you a chance. Yeah, the computer industry was growing. It was the days of mini computers. So anything, anybody was worth a try. So I went in and started at the bottom and kind of worked my way up. I guess it's a variant of a very classic story.
Well, wait a second. So you have no formal training in programming? Is that what you're saying?
No, I just made it all up. You know, I had a lot of good patient people who would straighten me out when I was doing particularly stupid things. But I think anybody who's a good programmer will tell you the same thing. You teach yourself. I mean, you can read in a book about certain things, you know, particular attributes of a language or something like that. But in the end, it's the long hours and figuring it out and trying all the things you're not supposed to until you figure out what works. So I think just about everybody at a high level in programming is an autodidact.
How did you get to Lexicon?
I had been in the programming industry for several years. I started out doing basically firmware for things that were used in medical imaging and seismology and that sort of thing. It was signal processing where you had these great huge racks full of gear. And I kind of moved around. I did speech recognition for a while, and then I wrote an operating system for a Kodak company. We were doing raster processing for magazines and newspapers and that sort of thing. And I got a call out of the blue. A headhunter thought I would enjoy this thing, so I went over. And I walked into Lexicon, and in those days, they were working on Opus, which was where I was to spend the next several years of my life. And there's this giant mixing desk editor thing, obsolete within 5 years of the time we shipped it. And I just felt like, oh, this is right. So, yeah, I turned in my notice in the old place and then was at Lexicon for the next 25 years.
Of course, you were lucky because Dave Griesinger there.
Yeah, Dave was a good teacher. Barry Blester was another. And between the two of them, I wasn't allowed to make too many missteps. So I learned at the knee of the guys who had put the industry together in a lot of ways.
But the thing that you had going for you is you were familiar with what instruments sound like, real instruments sound like, through your classical training, right? And what halls sound like. So that's the brilliant part there.
Well, that's true, but that was true of Dave as well, because Dave was sort of an amateur musician, but he recorded just about every large group in town in those days. So he had a real sensitivity to it as well. And I guess that's one reason that we found it easy to work together, is because when we talked about music, we were often talking about the same things. You know, my tastes were probably more radical than his, but there was still an awful lot of crossover between the two of us.
Oh, what were some of the projects that you worked on at Lexicon?
Well, I did mention Opus, and I was on Opus for, several years, I guess about 5 years. And, this thing, any really cheap $200 laptop will do what Opus did now. But in those days, you were in for $100,000 or $200,000 to get one of these systems. And I was happy that they stayed in facilities for a lot longer than they had any reason to, but people like them. But I had finally had enough of Opus and was really looking for something else to do there. So the first thing that I did after that was the PCM80. And I did operating system work on that and did a lot of work with Steve DeFuria, who you know.
Sure.
And Steve and I both had a background in analog synthesis. So there were a lot of things about wiring things together that you shouldn't, that were appealing to both of us. So we found it a lot of fun to work on a lot of the patching things and things that were in the 80. And from the 80, then I went on to the 90. And that was the first thing that I did any reverb in. At that point, I was mainly porting things that existed already. But even then, I was thinking, you know, I think I can improve this a little bit. So I began to tweak at that point. And then we had a number of sort of small things we did. We had a PCI card that we made. That was the Pro Tools killer that promptly fell on its own sword. So we did a number of those things. And then the 960L was probably the first big flagship Lexicon thing that I worked on. And those were the first things that we did with Surround. And so I did that. And then after that, it was the PCM96, and then all of the Lexicon plugins and a few other odds and ends along the way, and then here I am.
So when it comes to programming reverbs, that seems like a special talent.
Or an affliction. Yeah, it is, because it's really not what people think it is. A lot of people think that reverb is all about mathematics and things like that. And yes, that is a component. But it's, there are more of other things in there. There, you can certainly see some very scientific approaches to reverbs. You'll see that a lot in the convolution reverbs and things like that. And I've sort of made my feelings about that clear in a number of places. I'm not hugely impressed by the technology. And the reason is that it's overkill.
The technology of convolution?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it can make some really nice things. And if you got a recording of a nice hall, you'll get a nice reverb out of it. There's no doubt about that. But it's overkill because I don't think that's the way we hear. And that's one of the things that, even though Dave Griesinger and I differed in detail, we still have very similar feelings about the role of your neurological systems in this. I mean, it doesn't make any sense from an evolutionary standpoint to think about being able to perceive 20,000 reflections a second or something like that. It just doesn't. You'd have to eat 10 million calories a day for your brain to be able to do that stuff. So there's a lot of shorthand in the way that your hearing system works. Things like early reflections and that sort of thing are very important, because that's where you might know that there was some sort of predator sneaking up on you, and it's a real good idea to have a sense of where that predator is so you can run in the other direction. But there's really no evolutionary advantage in being able to hear reverb. I think it's just a side effect. So the art of programming reverberation is having a sense of what people will hear and what they want, because there's no point in wasting CPU cycles and effort on stuff that just doesn't make any audible difference at all. So that means that once you know what you're going to do, then a lot of it, I'll oversimplify it by calling an exercise in programming, but knowing how to program efficiently and knowing how to do those things is a real key in that. But the overall mathematics in reverb are actually quite simple.
I mean, if we go back to one of the most revered, and I guess the first digital reverb was the MT250.
Oh, yeah.
Which people still pay huge money for if they can find a working one. And really, I guess if you look at that, the converters were certainly not anything close to what we have today. And I guess the programming had to be way different and very primitive as compared to what we have today. And yet people still love the sound.
It is kind of funny, because Barry Blesser was the guy behind the programming of that box. And I talked to Barry fairly often. And he doesn't get it. His language is considerably more colorful than any language I'll use here. But he wonders why in the world people still like that thing, because it's like there's really nothing going on in there. It's all shortcuts, and it's all things. And I sort of suspect, you know, you've been in this business a while too, and you know habit is an important thing in this business.
Yeah.
And once you know where to pull the shift lever in a 250 and all of that sort of stuff, then you can do it, and then you just move on and do the rest of it. And the way that it sounds kind of slots into the way that a lot of people work. And if they've been doing it that way, they've got a path to success and they can use it. And why upset the apple cart? So I think it's the fact that people have learned how to use a device like that effectively and made, God, Lord knows how many hit records with that thing. I mean, you can go over, you know, the one at Capitol, that they yeah. worship that thing like it's the bone of St. Peter's or something. You know, it's shined up and, you know, just everything.
I can remember being on the Paramount stage once, and there was it was an orchestra recording for Star Trek, and Don mm-hmm. Hahn was the engineer, a very revered older engineer, and he had two 250s. And I remarked, and he says, you know, I cannot do a session without these. And he says, I always know exactly where my settings are. And he told me, I don't remember what it was, but it was 2.2 seconds here, you know, whatever. And that was his special sauce.
Yeah, and it's like, who's going to argue with that?
Yeah.
I mean, if it works, that's, yeah, there's not really right or wrong in this business. It's like, is it effective? And it is for a lot of people, so why change? So I'm the last person in the world to tell people they're wrong about this. If they're getting good results, it's like you tip your hat to how good they are as mix engineers and how well they know what they're doing. You know, that's all you can say. But it is amazing. Barry just, you know, all I got to say is EMT 250, and it's good for 5 minutes out of Barry. You know, you just wind him up and he goes.
Well, okay, on to another subject here. So your company, Exponential mm-hmm. Audio, has a couple of great reverbs, and I've been playing with the Phoenix reverb, which is wonderful. It sounds so nice. It blends in so well with everything. Tell me about that and the R2D2.
I'll answer your question, but I will say that I was not long after I shipped them, I was happy to be invited out to Skywalker Ranch to visit there. And I'm sitting around a table with some of the guys, and one of them looks at me, and they said, why'd you call it R2? And it took 3 or 4 beats before the penny dropped, and I knew what they were saying.
Yeah.
And my first thought was, oh, Lordy, am I getting sued? But no, they just were enjoying the joke. Phoenix Verb, what I was thinking about that, you know, I had to be, this is in quotes, the lexicon sound for a long time. And there was a lot good about that sound, but there was a lot that I didn't like as well. I thought there were so many artifacts in there, and people use them to advantage, just like they do with any other device. But none of the lexicon reverbs ever sounded that natural to me. And there were a number of reasons for that. And when I found myself putting together Exponential Audio, I realized I wasn't beholden to that sound any longer. It was remarkably liberating. And I thought about what the things might be that I could do to get toward that real, natural, unobtrusive sound. And a lot had to do with early reflections. In lexicon reverbs, this is largely a throwback to how little CPU there was available in those days. There's just not much going on in the early stuff. You know, you'd have a couple of delay lines and you could program in, oh, this is inverted, you know, -7 dB at 48 milliseconds, and you dial in a couple of those, and that was it. So about all you could do with that was maybe duplicate an artifact-filled stage house or something like that. So one of the important things for me in Phoenix Verb, and it actually turned out to be true for R2 as well, excuse me, was an early reflection engine that blended into the reverb more naturally. So something that just, it had the reflections which would kind of stage it and then go naturally into the reverb tail. So that was a lot of the focus of what I did. And then on the tail part, it was just having a tail that didn't do all the wobbly stuff that the Lexicon tails do. I mean, and again, they're very nice, and there's some things that it's kind of hard to beat that old sound with. But again, there were so many cases, especially with percussion, but with other things too, that you wanted a reverb in there, but you didn't want anybody to know you'd done it. You know, you just there are so many concert halls that have high-end classical recording going on that have help that nobody wants you to know about.
Yeah.
So it's how do you slot in some reverb and bring it up without anybody knowing? So that was a lot of the emphasis behind Phoenix Verb. R2, on the other hand, I was really going for something with some more color in that. I still wanted the early engine that could do the sort of things that Phoenix Verb does. But I also wanted some intentional pitch effects and some intentional wobble and some things like that, because there are some things like it's kind of hard to think of a classical guitar sounding nicer than with just that little tiny bit of undulation in the tail. People call it depth. It's not really depth. It's actually probably the farthest thing from depth. But it's a really nice effect. And I wanted a little bit of that. I also wanted to do it in a way that wasn't quite the same way that Lexicon had done it. But that was sort of the purpose of that. And I also wanted to have a mode in there that you may have run across already, which was a way in R2 to have some serious chorusing but not have any pitch effects. So that when a chorus is going up, another one's going down by the same amount. So instead of having anything that you can perceive as pitch, you just have this kind of fattening going on. It's kind of hard to describe, but you can get away with a whole lot of it before you give away the game.
Well, let's just come back a little bit. You were talking about how important the first reflection is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably the most overlooked part of reverb, especially for engineers or want to be engineers or just, let's just say, users. Because they're used to doing pre-delay and they're used to doing the reverb decay. And to some degree, that's kind of it. I mean, you mess around with everything else, but those are the most important. I think a lot of people misunderstand the pre-delay is not the first reflection as well.
It's important, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's also, I think, one of the things that's important to realize is how much recording has changed. In the days that the Lexicon 224 and 480 came out, still, most recording studios had some pretty decent rooms. I mean, you had a place where you weren't afraid to put the mic back a little bit and pick up some of the room, and then all you really needed a reverb for was to extend that. But those days, you know, a lot of those great studios are condos now or something else, or parking lots. So there are fewer and fewer people that have good rooms. The rooms may be smaller. They may be a bedroom or just a VO booth or something like that. But you can't count on having that nice sense of room in most recordings any longer because those places are gone. So I don't think that the Lexicon-style reverbs were inadequate for their day. I mean, they blended very nicely with the state of the art of recording, but that's all changed. You've also got more and more close mic recording for various reasons, like the world is awfully noisy now. So things that you might have done, with omnis or figure eights or something like that a while back, where you wouldn't have minded picking up, you know, what was on the back lobe because there wasn't a whole lot there. Now it's cardioids.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got those cardioids jammed in tight, and you're getting all of the harshness off of there, because especially if it's an acoustic instrument, you know, you're only getting one or two nodes of radiation off of that thing. You're not getting the whole sound field that comes off. So you have to take some of the harshness out of it as well. And that's one of those things that a more rich early reflection field can help you with, is just to virtually back off the source a little bit.
Well, is there a trick to using first reflection? Or a guideline?
Yeah, and I find most of the time I give guidelines, somebody does exactly the opposite and they get a perfectly good result. But the main trick, now I felt like I was dodging that one, and I'm not quite, but only a little. In a general sense, you can figure that more energy in the later part of the early reflections will move you back a little bit. So it'll move you away from the source some. That's kind of the general rule of thumb, and it works in a lot of cases. But that gets to one of the things that I decided to do in my user interface, because you've seen it. It's just rubber bands. You've got one thing that stretches how much time the early reflections take in total, and another that slopes whether the energy comes in the earliest part or the late part. Because I found, okay, I knew the Lexicon reverbs front and back, and I still hated trying to program, well, this should be 33 milliseconds and at this game, because you don't really know. You're putting some dry material through and playing with it until you like the sound. And I thought, okay, not only do I not really know what the number should be, but I don't care what the number should be. Mm-hmm. Because it's the ears that make the difference. So by rubber banding it and saying, oh, just move these two controls until you get what you like, and then that's the right answer. Yeah, who cares? Who cares what the numbers are?
Yeah.
Because, again, it's all situational. You know, you've got your recording in your room, and you're using the mics that you think are appropriate for that. Somebody else who's equally capable has made a completely different set of choices. And yeah, maybe the room's a little different. Maybe he's aiming for something a little different. So you can't dictate this is the way that it should be.
Yeah, you still have the variables of the player and the song and the arrangement on top of it, and that all plays into it. It's almost an infinite number of variables that you have.
Yeah, and you know, this piano sounds sweet as honey, and this one is like nails on a blackboard.
Yeah,
and you're trying to get the same kind of music out of each one. So again, it's like, Don't blind the guy with science. Just give him a quick way to make some adjustments. And if you like what you got, then that's the right answer.
But yet, there's a lot of variables within both of those reverbs, if you so choose to use them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is, yeah, the world is really divided between guys who want to tweak and the guys who don't. I mean, and you know, usually most rooms don't have the luxury of having, you know, a primary and a secondary engineer and a third guy. It may be the same guy doing everything. And some guys, like sound designers, I mean, they live to tweak.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to sell a scene. You know, because I was talking, you probably know Scott Gershon.
Oh, very well, yeah.
I was talking to Scott not too long ago, and we were talking about levels, and I generally confess that I'm generally happy with levels that are much lower than levels that he's happy with. But he says, look, I'm trying to sell a 200-foot-tall robot. What do you want me to do?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, he's right.
Yeah.
He's got that gig. I don't. But some guys, just by their nature, want to tweak.
Yeah.
And other guys would just rather go through the presets. No, 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 yes.
But that's the other thing. Your presets are great for the most part. I get the feeling with most plugins, most devices that have a lot of presets, sometimes it's almost like going through the motions to put them there. okay, we have 50 slots, so let's, you know, fill these up. But yet there's not a lot of variation or a lot of thought, seemingly, that goes into some of them. But with yours, they all seem usable, and there's a reason for them all.
Well, you know, the good thing, customers are really good about telling you what you need to do. And it's a good idea to listen as often as you can. And if some guy says, I need more small rooms, I need more bathrooms, you know, I need more football fields or whatever, you do everything you can to oblige him. But one of the lessons I learned at Lexicon is I used to go back into customer service and just talk to the guys just to see, you know, what was coming in the door and what they were doing. And one of the things that was true time after time is a unit would come in for service and they would always look to see how many presets the owner had made. One or two.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe three if somebody was ambitious. And you realize, whatever the reasons, whether it's the user interface doesn't work, or the person doesn't have enough time, or they don't understand the architecture, or they're just not inclined that way, most people rely on the presets. And there are probably so many good boxes that have been capable of so much more. And people tend to slot them into, well, this does that. I like these three presets, so I'll throw this in the rack for that. And this other one does that. And it might very well be that any of those is capable of doing all of those things. But the owner is just not going to have time to get in and dig that deeply and make it happen. So I feel it's an obligation for me. And yeah, there are times after a long day of preset programming that it's like, I need a bib. But, you know, you learn things too. I mean, it's a great way to debug because you'll find yourself in a situation that you'll do something and lying on the ground and realize, I'm glad I found that before somebody else did.
You just came out with Excalibur, which is different from your first two products in that it's not exclusively reverb, it's more effects. But it also harkens back to the PCM80 days, for instance, and without you know, going back there so much. you know what I mean? It's not a PCM80, but it's a very cool box. And like we were talking before, I love the guitar presets. The guitar presets just seem to work in the mix. I don't know how you got them, but wow, great.
It's, well, I plug in the list and see what it does, you know. And, you know, I mentioned this to you offline. It's a real danger that I decided not to wade into. I don't have a house full of cabinets and different heads and things like that. So the last thing I'm going to try to do is tell you, you know, this is a high watt with 10-inch speakers, and this is a Marshall cab, and this is a twin reverb, because if you make a call like that, people who live with those things will slap you down really hard,
yeah,
because they know where you're wrong. So my approach is more like, is this useful?
Yeah.
Okay. This is, yeah, I'll go back to those old custom rolled and pleated transistor amps. Yeah. The first generation of transistor amps. So I know what they sounded like, and I had tube amps in those days and all of that sort of stuff. So my thinking more is like, is this useful? Okay. This is going to be sort of like a vintage cabinet with 10-inch speakers or 12s or something like that. And that was a good general sound. And I would really rather have people play with the presets and find something they like and not care that it's a particular model of anything else. Because, you know, so many of those things, if they're trying to sound like, you know, Hendrix or Jimmy Page or Wes Montgomery or something like that, that depends so much on the situation and what the mics were and where
the player.
They are. Yeah. And the player has some small, you know, input into that whole thing. So you can have a perfect emulation of one of those cabinets, And the player still won't sound at all like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's like it gets down to the pick and everything else. Yeah. And
well, tell me more about Excalibur. So how did that come about? Why did that come about?
Oh, a sickness, I suppose. You mentioned going back to the PCM-80. This actually goes back to way before that. My introduction really to electronic music was standing in front of a great big old ARP 2500 modular synth.
Wow.
You know, I had played
I remember
with
those.
Oh, man, they were something. What a nightmare
yeah.
in so many ways. You know, I played with a Mini Moog before that and done some stuff. But when I got into school, you know, we had a big three-bay 2500 and some 2600s and various other odds and ends. And, you know, you could just stand there and load up. You take all the patch cables off the peg on the wall and throw them over your arm. And when you were out of cables, you were done patching. But, you know, it just wasn't manly if you didn't use every single cable. But those things were so flexible, and you could plug anything into anything. Mm-hmm. And it might not be useful. Most of the time it wasn't. But there was always something you could learn, and it'd give you an idea for the next time. So it was that flexibility in moving things around and using things to control things and all of that. Now Excalibur doesn't do a lot of the things that all those modular synths used to do, and it'll do a few things that they didn't. But it was sort of the idea of a block of units that you could put together in a whole lot of different ways. And that was the basic thing. I mean, no architecture can be completely open and completely free. You know, you do have to wire it up in the background so that things can happen. But using it so that you could pursue a crazy idea and see if it was any good or not. And yeah, I'm discovering things with it every day. You know, it's like, oh man, I didn't think of that. I should have made a preset. So then I will, and yeah, it'll always be in the next version. And then I'll hear, you know, a lot of my testers did their own presets and things like that, and things that I wouldn't have thought of. And that's always the most rewarding when you think you understand something completely, and someone comes right out of the blue and says, "I bet you didn't know it could do this."
Yeah.
And you think, oh, that's really cool.
Well, Michael, explain Excalibur then. Explain the different effects blocks.
Okay. At its heart, it's a four-voice delay processor. So you could use it just as that and stay busy for days. So each voice is basically a path from input to output. So you could set up one or two inputs for each voice. So you could say, "Oh, I want the left channel input," or I could have a summed mono input, or maybe the output from one of the other voices. So that's the input, and then it goes through some diffusion. It goes through some delay if you want delay, and then it has a feedback path and a path to output, and all of those things have got multi-mode filters on them, so you can do stuff like that. And even just in that limited view, everything can be modulated. So you can have, for instance, delay time can be modulated. It can be modulated by tempo, so you can have, you know, a delay that's the length of a quarter note or a, you know, dotted eighth or whatever you need. It can be modulated by input level. It can be modulated by a random generator or by low-frequency oscillators or any of those things. So you can do that stuff. You can modulate the cutoff frequency of the filters. You can do lots of things like that. So at that point, it's still a very flexible one, but it's still just a delay processor, and you can, you know, modulate the output pans and all of that stuff. Then where it gets a little crazy is that each voice has an optional voice effect, so that you can have, whether you're using the delay or not, you can drop a ring modulator or a flanger or a phaser or a pitch shifter or a reverb, several other effects into that path so that you can have a delay voice that also flanges or no delay, it just flanges. Most of those voice effects can actually have post effects, not all of them. I realized at some point there was some of the engine that I wasn't using, so why not tie it in? So, for instance, if you've got a resonant filter, which is the old kind of Mutron effect, the auto-wah or any a number of other things, well, it'll drop right into the flanger as well. And that's still within the context of a single voice. So you can have one voice that's doing the delay and all of that stuff and running through an auto wah or an auto high pass or something like that, and then running through a flanger and then a panner and then on to output. Or you don't have to send it to output at all. You can send it on to another voice. Or there are actually several places in the signal path that you can tap out to send to another voice. You can tap out before it goes to EQ, before it goes to effect, post effect, several things depending on what you want to do. So if you're getting really on the crazy side, then you might have one voice that's doing ring modulation. You might have another that's doing flange. You might have another pair that are doing stereo reverb that's running into chorus. And because of the way the modulation works, and because a couple of those modulator sources are front panel controls, you can do things like go radically between a couple of different effects. So that you might have an effect that if your knob is in one position, it's a reverb, and you move the knob in another position, and it becomes flanging echo delay. You might have that so it's controlled by input level or any of several sort of thresholding modulators or things like that. I've got... Again, I'm still discovering things myself. Again, I just thought it up. It doesn't mean I understand it completely.
But it's very cool. It will do so much. And like I say, the presets are dynamite, which, once again, that's when it comes down to it, that's kind of the selling point, because it's the first thing you do. You call up a bunch of presets and see what it's like. You know, I mean, even the people that tweak a lot, that's you have to start from somewhere. So,
well, you know, I'm in the same situation. I have so little spare time that if I'm playing with somebody else's plugin or something else, I know there's a world under there that I should explore, but I rarely have time to. So a lot of times my picture of it is just dialing through the presets and saying, is this something I want to come back to?
Yeah, yeah.
And moving on from that. People are busy. You know, people are they're doing their recording, they're doing their mixing, their PR, their mastering, everything. So you got to save them as much time as you can.
You know, you've been deep into surround reverbs for a long time, and with your new company, you've also explored that quite a lot. I mean, there's surround versions for everything. Is there a surround version for Excalibur? Is that
no? That's going to depend on whether there's demand.
Yeah.
You know, I've talked with a lot of sound designers about it, and quite a few of them are still happy to have just mono or stereo effects and to place it into the field where they want to place it, because as soon as you start doing surround stuff and lighting up all of the channels, especially considering that post is the major outlet for surround these days, they have so many other considerations. They've got a busy mix. They've got dialogue up here. They've got Foley over there. They've got a particular effect that they want to hear coming out of the right rear or something like that. And if you're doing an effect that lights up all the speakers, you might actually be stepping on what it is that they need to do there. So a lot of them would really just rather have stereo and then steer it around, because, you know, you can use the Dolby or the RO panner and put anything, you know, exactly where you want it. Now, having said that, I have been asked about it. So I know there is some interest there, and you know we'll just see what happens with that. I mean, it sounds like it would be fun to do,
You know, another thing is 3D audio, which seems to be a coming trend in the business.
Yeah.
And you seem to be on top of that, much more so than many other effects designers.
Well, that's the nice thing about not working in a big company. You know, you can take your chances on things. And I have found that the companies that make the 3D solutions, and again, this is primarily Dolby and RO, are both really good people to work with. They've been more than receptive of my ideas and willing to play with it and give me feedback. And post engineers are the same way. I mean, they're always looking for the advantage too.
Yeah.
You know, because just the fact that you've got a couple of gold statues doesn't mean you'll have another job ever in your whole life, or that's the way that it feels sometimes.
Yeah.
So they're looking for that too. But a lot of it is just you have to be bold. You have to be willing to take some risk and experiment. You know, my room here is now 14.1.
No kidding.
So, yeah.
Oh, I see it. Yeah, okay.
You can't do it if you can't hear it, you know.
Yeah.
It's a cobble together 14.1. We're not talking an industry standard room or anything like that. But you know, I can it's reasonably treated and I can compensate. So you have to do those things. And you know, it's kind of sad that the major workstation manufacturers don't have a solution for this yet.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a few of the smaller ones do, and I'm in conversation with them because, you know, it's like I want them to be rewarded for being bold as well. But the standard workstations that most people use day in and day out don't really have solutions for, you know, for anything past 7.1.
Yeah, right.
So I had to kind of find a way to work around that and to be able to have communication between a pair of plugins, you know, one on high channels and one on low channels,
yeah.
And figure out how to share data effectively and dependably there. So that was a huge amount of fun and made me sometimes use language that my mother wouldn't want to hear. But that's another thing.
Okay, two more questions. Uh-huh. So what are some tricks with reverb that people don't know? Or some uses that people aren't aware of?
Oh, they could probably teach me on that too. Of course, the big rule of thumb in reverb is turn it up to where you think it's right, then turn it down too, and come back and listen tomorrow. It's one of those things. Reverb is such a subtle effect, especially if you're approaching it late in the day or, you know, after a long session, that sometimes you bring up more than you should just so that you can hear the effect. And then the next day it's sort of, oh, what was I thinking? Or worse yet, the client says, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
So it's always one of those things that is most effective a little bit below where you perceive that it's going on. The other thing is that reverberation can be tremendously useful when you're not using it as reverb at all. There are cases where you might turn down the reverb time down to a minimum. And then you play with different parameters in the reverb, just keeping the time as short as you can. And, you know, maybe you're talking, you know, 50, 60 milliseconds, something like that, if you can get it down that low. And then playing with the early reflection stuff and then using it to kind of glue the mix. This can be especially helpful if you've been using multi-mic techniques in a dry space with a lot of close miking and stuff like that, because it always sounds like, oh, it was close miked with a lot of mics and it doesn't glue. And
right,
that,
right.
That's the problem that the mixer has to worry about all the time. How do I make this feel like of a piece? And sometimes using just that bit of a reverb, which is primarily a little filtering and a whole lot of reflection stuff at a low level, we'll put those things into the same place.
But the real problem there is, yes, I agree, and it's a wonderful effect, but the real problem is there are so many reverb plugins and hardware reverbs that just don't sound good when you turn them down, when you turn the decay down. They boing, they're harsh, they don't sound good.
Yeah, well, I can't speak to that without sounding nasty. But I guess the important thing to keep in mind is there have been a number of reverb architectures built over the years. A lot of them have some things in common, but it's sometimes the hardest thing to let go of the solution that was the right solution 10 years ago. You know, we have, especially if you've tuned it and tweaked it and got it so it was just right, and now it was running on this whatever DSP you had in the box, or it was running on your, you know, Pentium 60 megahertz processor or something like that. But the fact is now, like almost any computer you buy has got clock speeds up in the gigahertz and has got tens of gigabytes of very fast memory and all of that. So you can kind of rethink the solutions, and you really have to, because that thing that maybe you wanted to do, maybe you dreamed about it 20 years ago, wouldn't it be great if I could do that and I wouldn't have to keep making compromises? Well, chances are that you can do that now, but you have to indulge in a little creative destruction and sort of say goodbye to a good old trusty solution that no longer can do it any longer, and take a look at, you know, what the computers can do now and what the tools can do now, and try to think, is there a better way to solve this problem?
You know, something else is kind of interesting that I just want to throw it out here. I do a lot of, on my blog, a lot of isolated tracks that I find on YouTube, and they usually come from either an isolated surround track where there's a, you know, a track that's just in the left rear or something, or from GarageBand. There's a lot of individual tracks. And what's always interesting, and even when I go back and I listen to full mixes from songs from the 60s and 70s, the amount of reverb that was used and the length of it is pretty amazing, actually. It's not things that we do today, but, you know, you'll have 4-second reverb on a fast, you know, rock song, and it will blend into the track. You don't even hear it unless you actually, you know, can isolate that, you know, that vocal track or something. What's the difference between then? I know, obviously, we're in the analog world and we're talking about plates and halls, but boy, it sure worked then really well.
Yeah, it still works. I mean, there's 8 chambers at Capitol that still get work every day, you know, and those are, the reverb time in those things is incredibly long. And, you know, you're not going to fill them full of pillows to damp it down. You sort of deal with what it is. And even if you could put dampers on a plate, you know, plate reverbs can still be long. I think a lot of it had to do with level, that the reverb was perhaps as a little lower level. Some of it had to do with pre-delay, because there was quite generous pre-delay in a lot of those things. Lots of times it might be a chunk of tape, in between you and the chamber or something like that. But they used enough pre-delay to back it out and to keep it from cluttering up whatever was going on. And then one of the other things may be that, you know, the signal to noise was not near what it is now. Mm. You know, on an LP, you know, you'd be lucky, to tell the truth, and now I'll get all the purists on me now, but, you know, if you could hear, you know, 45 or 50 dB below the loudest thing you could get out of an LP, you were doing pretty well. And tape and cassette, sort of the same way. So that reverberation would just disappear, right, and all the hiss and all the other stuff. So it didn't seem to be there. The threshold of that, you know, it was a fairly short horizon before you got there. Now, you know, you're 2496, 24192. You can hear that stuff, you know, until, you know, forever.
You know, it's I never considered that, but you're right. I bet that had so much to do with it. And the fact that you're also going multiple generations of tape, you know, so no matter what, you're on tape and you lose something there, and then you mix down to tape again, so you're another generation down, and then finally it goes to, you know, you're making a master after that. So, you know, that had a lot to do with it too, obviously.
And then over to the mother, and then over to the stampers, sure. And it's like it was all gone at that point. Sure. So you probably had to use a lot even to get anywhere. But you know, it was also part of the vocabulary of the style.
Yeah, yeah, right.
You know, and it's what, I mean, you listen to the Beatles recordings, and they're soaked.
Yeah, right.
But again, the arrangements, until you got into the late stuff, they were pretty sparse arrangements.
Yeah.
So a lot of it was just kind of avoid dead air.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. Glue, yeah. All right, last question. So what's the best piece of business advice that you either learned or someone imparted to you along the way? Or music business advice?
It's a people business. It's, yeah, I make technology for a living, and I sell technology, and I'm glued to the computer far more than I should be, and so is everybody else in the business. But this is really about talking to people. People aren't sold by specifications. They aren't really, they hear that stuff all day long. They don't care. What people in this business have is problems to solve. You know, if you're a producer, you've got to have people skills like nobody else. You've got to make a singer relax so that he or she can give you everything they've got and not feel like they're being held under a microscope or any of that. It's about making that person comfortable. If you're in a position like me and you're trying to make a plugin that you hope someone will use, then you ask. You talk to them about it. You say, you know, well, what's hurting you? What's eating up all your time? You know, what gets you yelled at? And can you help with something like that? Because that matters more than anything else. And it's kind of one of the joys of this business now. You know, we went through the big business phase with huge manufacturers and all of that. Everybody kind of soaked up everybody else. And there's still a few there, but they really don't have the impact that they once did. And it's like the business has gotten like it was 30 years ago. Most of the vendors are small shops like mine. There are an awful lot of people. If people knew how many major movies got mixed in home studios these days, at least some part of it, they would be amazed. Yeah. And can they drive by those places every day and don't even know they're there?
Yeah.
And it's about knowing how to make people comfortable and knowing how to solve some problems. And to do that, you just got to talk to them. Simple as that.
Great advice. Great advice. Michael, thank you for being with me today. It was great.
Oh, thank you, Bobby.
Really appreciate it. To find out more about Michael and Exponential Audio, go to exponentialaudio.com. That's one word, exponentialaudio.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I really love to hear your questions and comments. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put this podcast together. Thank you kindly, Steve. Really appreciate it. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and on bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I will see you next time.